Yeah, it seems to be. Good. Okay, so thanks very much to Daniel for inviting me to give a colloquium. I'm going to talk about a subject which is both very elementary and very open-ended. And actually, it was a surprise to me that this whole area of research even existed. I thought, like most other people, that George Gamow had solved the problem of quantum tunneling in the 1920s. The more I thought about it, the more I realized how inadequate the usual descriptions of tunneling are, especially when you're studying time-dependent phenomena. So in the usual description of tunneling, one, for example, uses the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and you just describe wave functions for fixed energy. And that's all very well, except that experiments are now reaching a point where we really can probe phenomena like quantum tunneling in real time with precisions of femtoseconds, for example, in chemistry. And so clearly a description based on energy eigenstates is not the ideal one. One wants a description which is a real-time description. So the only paper that exists is this one, and I have to mention a funny story here, which is this is my first ever foray into quantum foundations or related topics, and so I saw this journal, which is an online journal, which is great, so a paper that appears there is published online, available free to anyone, and in all naivety, I just submitted my paper there. But I thought I would send it to the Quantum PH archive, since that seemed most appropriate. Now, if you submit a paper to this journal, there's a funny rule, which is that if you have posted it on the HEP-TH or HEP-PH archive, there's no publication charge. But if you submit it to the Quant PH archive, you have to pay about $1,500. And the reason for this is a subsidy which comes from CERN. And so I just advise everyone to use this journal, but don't follow my example. And if you're going to send something there, put it on the HEP-TH archive first. It's rather strange. Anyway, so I had to pay the publication charge. So I'm going to describe a very elementary approach to quantum tunneling using complex classical paths, which are strange things that you may not have thought about. There really is a vast range of applications from foundational questions of quantum mechanics, as I'll be discussing later in the talk, whether reality is real, okay, in the sense of whether reality should be described using real numbers or complex numbers. And we'll get to this halfway through the talk. There are applications in quantum chemistry, the evaporation of black holes, and even the validity of the inflationary multiverse. And I haven't actually mentioned here, but the topic I'll talk about the end, which is the fate of the universe. If we forget about inflation, what we know from the Large Hadron Collider, at least if we extrapolate to high energies and assume no additional physics, we know that our vacuum is unstable. And the way it will go unstable is through quantum tunneling, which we can describe in the method I'll explain in this talk. Now, tunneling is interesting because it's not just difficult, it's impossible, according to classical mechanics. So this is analogous to the problem of building a quantum computer, which many of you may be interested in. Quantum computers are better than classical computers for some things, but quantum tunneling is more dramatic case because it's actually something that is just impossible classically, but quantum allowed. So that makes it very interesting from the point of view of understanding the special features of quantum as opposed to classical mechanics. The way I'll describe it was very much influenced by a talk Yakir Aharonov gave at Perimeter a couple of years ago, in which he emphasized the concept of post-selection, and I'll hope to sort of demystify this for people from backgrounds like myself in quantum field theory and so on by just telling you that this is actually the natural and completely obvious interpretation of the Feynman path integral. This post-selection gets directly related to the semi-classical expansion and what it means to approximate the world as classical. I'm going to make predictions for real-time weak measurements, again a concept of Aharonov's, that when a quantum system is undergoing some transition, you do not need to observe it strongly and collapse the wave function. You can have it interact with another system very weakly, and through that interaction, you can learn about what the quantum system was doing without interfering with it. And so that's a very important idea. And so what I will show is that if you make weak measurements of a particle during tunneling, during this classically impossible process, you can learn about where the quantum particle is and without collapsing the wave function. And the result is very interesting. Then I'll talk about an extension to quantum field theory and gravity. In the case of gravity, really our only hope of making contact between quantum gravity and, let's say, the real-world application of gravity to black holes or cosmology is through this semi-classical expansion. So in gravity, this connection between the quantum and semi-classical theory is most important of all. Then I'll talk about other things. So let me begin from the beginning. Let's start with the expression for the wave function, Schrodinger wave function, given by the Feynman path integral. And just to remind you, the path integral is a kernel, an integral kernel, which takes you from some initial wave function at initial time, ti, to a final wave function at time tf. And you can think about this as, so for example, I'm working in the position basis, and so the final wave function here is a delta function of x minus x final, and I can think of the general transition amplitude as being the convolution or the integral of the initial wave function, the kernel, and some final wave function. And so this expression naturally incorporates both pre- and post-selection. The pre-selection is the choice of initial wave function. The post-selection is the final wave function. You integrate these two pre- and post-selected wave functions against the kernel, and that gives you the quantum amplitude. Now, the point is, once you have this amplitude between an initial and a final state, you can take the limit h bar goes to zero. And in the limit h bar goes to zero, you expect this integral, it's an infinite dimensional integral, but you expect it to be dominated by one or more saddle points. Because when h bar goes to zero, this exponent oscillates very rapidly, and the dominant contribution to the integral will come from those paths for which the exponent is stationary. And so classical solutions should dominate. There may be one or more of them. And then there's an obvious point, which is that saddle points are generically complex. If you think of doing some integral along the real x-axis, just a one-dimensional integral, of some function, which is e to the function of x, well, the solutions to df dx equals zero are generically complex. And so saddle point solutions are generally complex, and they dominate, or they determine the integral in the limit as h bar goes to zero. So a lot of this talk will be about studying these solutions, these complex solutions, and interpreting them. And as I'll describe later, even though the solution is complex, in other words, the particle really does follow a complex trajectory in going from its starting position to its final position, we can introduce another system which interacts with our quantum system. weakly, very weakly, and this complex nature of the trajectory the system follows will show up in the effect on our the quantum system we're studying and the measurement, the weak measurement system which interacts with it. So let's start with a simple example. Let's do a particle in a potential, x squared minus x to the fourth. So that is a simple tunneling potential, and we're imagining setting up some initial wave function that sits in the false vacuum, and then waiting for the particle to jump out of the, to quantum jump out of the potential and to roll down the hill towards infinity, where it escapes. So in this case, so here is, for this particular potential, there are a couple of, there are a few dimensional parameters. We can scale them all out into a single overall dimensionless coefficient, which is this, and multiplied by a completely dimensionless action. So from now on, time is going to be measured in the period of oscillations in the false vacuum. Okay, that's a natural time scale. Space is going to be measured in the width of the barrier. Okay, so this distance from the false vacuum to the zero crossing of the potential defines a length scale, and I'm going to measure all distances in those units. So having made that change of variables, the problem is entirely dimensionless, and when I say I'm going to take h bar to goes to zero, it's really this dimensionless number which I'm taking to infinity. Okay, so let's look for classical solutions in this problem. Okay, as I said, the quantum mechanical amplitude should be dominated by one or more saddle points, or i.e. classical solutions. And so your first guess is to look for zero energy solutions. Now, zero energy solutions obviously do not tunnel. There are two types, one where the particle sits at zero and has no kinetic energy, or there's a solution where the particle rolls in from infinity, bounces off the potential, and rolls back out to infinity. These are the only zero energy solutions, and they do not describe tunneling. That's a little bit of a strong statement, because actually this solution is used to describe tunneling. And that solution is, in fact, the Euclidean bounce. That's the solution which Coleman and others, Callan and Coleman and others, developed in the 1970s to give a Euclidean time picture of tunneling. So here is the solution, which rolls in from infinity, bounces off. It's just 1 over sine t, so that at t equals 0, this, so think of t being, negative, and so at t equal to 0, the solution is off at infinity, and then as t increases to the solution here is minus 1 over sine t. So if you take, for example, t to be minus pi over 2, the solution is at 1. And if I follow it forward to t going to 0, the particle from below, you see the particle will rush off to infinity. Now, if you take that solution and look in the complex t-plane, so here's t equals 0 where the particle hit infinity, you follow it back to t equals minus pi over 2 where the particle was on the barrier, but then instead of keeping going, in which case you'd find the particle go back off to infinity, instead of going on in the real t-axis, if you go up the imaginary, up in the imaginary t-direction, then you will find you change variables to tau. So tau will be 0 when t is minus pi over 2. And then tau will tau will go to negative values and go off to minus infinity. Well, if you do that, change from t to tau, then of course the in the action, the x dot squared term is going to change sign relative to the potential, and so the particle thinks it's moving in an upside down potential. So I just take the potential, flip it upside down, and now I find there's a solution which starts at tau equals zero, where x equals one, and as tau goes to minus infinity, the solution goes and lands exactly on the top of the false vacuum, okay, flipped upside down. So it's the same solution we had outside, but just analytically continued to find this under the barrier trajectory in Euclidean time. And furthermore, we can calculate the exponent in the functional integral, just this quantity here, by regarding the time integral, integral dt, as a contour integral, and then performing it along this contour, I'll end up integrating the Euclidean action, which is exactly the same as the IS, Lorentzian action, but along a different contour. And when I do this integral, I get a third. So the amplitude for the wave function computed in this way is e to the minus one-third divided by h bar, that dimensionless h bar I defined earlier. So this is the Euclidean bound solution that describes tunneling semi-classically, starting from a false vacuum. And it's a very beautiful and very powerful method. But it's got quite a few drawbacks. One of them is the dependence on the initial state is completely implicit. I mean, you don't put into the formalism anywhere what your initial state was. Okay? So in this example, it's quite clear that I'm free to pick any initial state here. I could pick a Gaussian, I could pick any other function, I could displace it, I could give it some momentum. None of these things are allowed in the Euclidean approach. Instead, one simply asks that the solution at tau equals minus infinity lands at the top of the hill. So the definition of the initial state is completely implicit, which means you can't play with it. And so it's not representing properly the physical fact that the metastable state is actually somewhat arbitrary. There is no special initial state because the problem is metastable. So the second problem is you can't easily answer real-time questions. So for example, I can tell you where the particle was at every moment of Euclidean time, but that's not much use to an experimentalist. Okay, experimentalists do not work in Euclidean time, and so that's not a particularly interesting prediction. Another problem, so we can't in fact say how it got through the barrier. It got through the barrier by traveling in Euclidean time. Well, thanks a lot. It doesn't really give me much of a picture and doesn't make any predictions about weak measurements or any other processes I might envisage. It's very hard to extend to time-dependent Hamiltonians. Obviously, if I started off with a problem where this was explicitly time-dependent, then the Euclidean method totally fails. Okay? Whereas in the method I'll describe, it's absolutely the same. The method is absolutely the same, whether or not the potential is time-independent or time-dependent. Especially in cosmology, where the background space-time is always time-dependent, the Euclidean approach is very, very limited. And as I'll describe later in the talk, this has led, I believe, to some serious conceptual mistakes that people have used Euclidean instantons because those are the only things which were available, and they have interpreted them in certain ways which are, I believe, incompatible with the real-time picture. Well, can we do any better? As I've said, this transition amplitude, if I stick to real time, I don't go to Euclidean time, there should be a classical solution, one or more classical solutions describing the transition from the false vacuum to the true vacuum. Now, this is just the equation of motion of the particle here is a second order differential equation, and so we can study the general solution. It's not difficult. And the solutions which describe tunneling have to be one or more of those solutions. So the general classical solution to this problem is just x double dot equals minus dv dx. The general solution is specified by two numbers. And it should be complex, because there's no, we're trying to do an integral by the saddle point method, and generally the saddle points will be complex. So the energy, E, and the time delay, T naught, are the two parameters that describe the general solution. This is particular to the case where I have time translation invariance. One of the integration constants of the differential equation is trivial. It's just a shift in the time. The second integration constant is the energy, which is a constant because of the time translation invariance. So even though now I'm specializing to the case where the potential is time independent, this is just technical. This is just going to allow me to study the solutions very easily. In principle, we can do exactly the same thing if the potential is time dependent, but these two constants would have a different interpretation. So the first thing to look at in this case is real energy solutions. And then it's obvious from the form of the potential that for real energy, all solutions are periodic. Okay, so you can either be wobbling backwards and forwards in the false vacuum, you can be running in from infinity and back out to infinity. In this potential, you go to infinity in finite time, and you come in from infinity in finite time. And so the interpretation that they're periodic is implicitly some kind of identification being used at infinity. Okay, and that's what I'm going to use. But with that identification, all the solutions are periodic. And they obviously don't represent tunneling. There's no real energy solution which represents tunneling. Tunneling means I start in the false vacuum and I end going off to infinity. So they all are for energy equals zero. If I allow this T naught, so if T naught is real, then I get only those two solutions I showed you before. If T naught is real, then the particle is either sitting in the false vacuum or rolling in and out. If T naught is imaginary, I can take this solution, the 1 over sine minus T, shift the argument by T naught, and I get very different solutions. Okay, so in particular, if T naught is very large and imaginary, one of these exponentials in the sine will dominate, and x of t will be very small. And so that's this case. If T naught is very large and imaginary, basically I end up going around in a circle around the origin. And so you could say that was a false vacuum solution. And the other limit, if T naught is very small and imaginary, then I roll in from infinity, roll back out to infinity, but because of the tiny imaginary part, this trajectory is actually going to come around here and run back in from the other side and then round out to infinity and so on. And so all the solutions are periodic, and one can show that in general, when energy is real, every solution is periodic. So none of these describe tunneling. Okay, what happens is that if the energy has a small imaginary part, then this tiny imaginary part will drive a sequence of solutions, or drive an evolution in which we effectively evolve from this E equals zero solution outwards into this solution going off to infinity. So we're going to see this in some detail. It's useful in this problem to write down the general solution, which is given by a Jacobi elliptic function. And for those of you who haven't studied them, they're basically nonlinear versions of trigonometric functions. And that's how they arise. So the SN function is basically a nonlinearly deformed sine wave. And the parameter, they have a parameter m, which specifies the energy of the solution. So M can be either real or complex. T naught can be real or complex. And these are the solutions we'll have to study. Now, for either x to the fourth potential or x cubed, as I'll deal with later, these functions have very beautiful analyticity properties in the complex T-plane. And I'll be able to use this to connect the real-time tunneling to the imaginary time tunneling in a very direct way. It is not true for higher-order polynomial potentials, like x to the fifth or x to the sixth. Generally, you get branch cuts and more complexity. Those cases are still extremely interesting, but would be more intricate to analyze. I'm not going to talk about them, but they could be analyzed in the same way. So here's our solution. As I said, the Jacobi elliptic functions turn out to be doubly periodic in the complex T-plane. If U is the argument of the function, then which is just related to T by a constant and a shift, then the SN function is doubly periodic in U. It has two quarter periods, K and K prime, which is just K of 1 minus M. And these are just numbers that depend on the energy. K describes, or rather 2K describes the distance between poles. This elliptic function only has poles as its singularities. That's actually rather easy to see, because if you write down the condition for energy to be conserved, it involves half x dot squared and then minus a half x to the fourth. So if x goes to infinity, you've got x dot going like x squared, and the solution of that is that x goes like 1 over t. So you can read off that the only solutions are simple poles. They are separated by 2k in the complex t-plane. And poles and zeros are separated by I times k prime, where k prime is some other complex number. And then the whole complex t-plane or u-plane is tiled by this parallelogram, and which is its fundamental domain. And the function is absolutely periodic under displacements by either 2k or ik prime. Any integer number of those displacements of the argument returns you to the same function. So they're very nice properties of the x cubed and x to the fourth potentials, which make the analysis particularly clear. So for small complex energy, which is what we're interested in, small values of this parameter n, it turns out that k is pi over 2. So the period of a particle to roll in from infinity and back out to infinity is just pi, okay, because it goes like 1 over sine t. So as t goes from 0 to pi, the solution goes from infinity to infinity. And so k is pi over 2. And then it has a small m-dependent correction. K prime is more interesting. You see this K prime, as m goes to 0, as the energy goes to 0, K prime diverges logarithmically. And what that means is that this parallelogram is going to get very tall. And as m prime really goes to 0, the height of the parallelogram is going to go to infinity. And this turns out to be the origin of the Euclidean instanton solution. Euclidean instanton solution, roughly speaking, goes from a zero to down to a negative real-time value, minus pi over 2, and that's the limit. It's described in the limit as m goes to 0 and k prime goes to infinity. Now, again, because of these very special analyticity properties of the elliptic functions, there's a nice expansion in terms of something called a gnome. And I had no idea what gnome stood for but when I wrote my paper. But then I gave a talk somewhere, and someone said, that's name in Italian. Okay, so apparently this is thought of as the name of the function, the gnome. That's easier to remember. Q is a number which is small when the energy is small. So if we define this as the quantity times the time, essentially this will be the periodicity of the function in time in it's this period, it's the 2k, then there's this expansion in terms of the solution, the general solution, as a function of T naught and m is given by this expansion. So at small energy, the higher energy, higher Q dependence is small, and this is much easier to analyze because these are just ordinary trigonometric functions now. So we'll use this expansion. It's called a Lambert expansion. And like all of this mathematics was worked out in the 19th century. Now, let's get back to a physical problem. Let us choose some particular initial state. So I'm going to pick my particle to sit in a Gaussian wave function around the false vacuum with some value of L. So this is a Gaussian wave packet. So that psi squared has a variance of L squared. And that's my Gaussian wave function. And so I'm just going to insert that wave function into the path integral here. Okay, so it goes like e to the minus x initial squared. To find the saddle point, I just stationarize the exponent with respect to x initial. The minus x initial squared will contribute minus x initial when I differentiate it. When I differentiate the classical action, I use the Hamilton-Jacobi formula that ds dx initial is p initial, okay, for any classical solution. And so I infer this boundary condition. So x initial plus I times p initial is zero. Now for a false vacuum ground state, but I should have put an h bar in here actually. This should really be square root of h bar. The h bars all cancel if I take L, the ground state, to be the local harmonic oscillator state, so whose wave function goes like e to the minus x squared over h bar. So the h bars all cancel. L should be square root of h bar over 2, and this equation reduces to x plus I x dot equals 0. So this is the right initial condition for a Gaussian wave packet, which is the local harmonic oscillator ground state wave function. So very simple initial condition, but notice that it involves an I, okay? That the saddle point solution for this problem has an I right at the beginning. The boundary conditions are mixed. X equals X final at T equals T final, and x plus ix dot equals 0 at t equals t initial. If you chose to displace the Gaussian or to change its width, you would, or to give it some momentum, you would introduce a complex number on the right-hand side here, or you would change the coefficient of x dot. Okay, so all of these things can be incorporated very simply into this formalism. You can describe the classical solution for any one of those problems. What this condition means, those of you who do quantum field theory in curved spacetime, for example, are completely familiar with this condition in another guise. This is just the Bunch-Davies vacuum, or incoming positive frequency state. So the assumption there is that my field, quantum field, has all of its modes in the harmonic oscillator ground state of the incoming of the harmonic oscillator incoming ground state. And that just amounts to positive frequency condition. So all of this is, you see, if x goes like any number times e to the it, which is positive frequency, then this condition is satisfied. So the initial condition is that x is pure positive frequency with arbitrary amplitude. Final condition, x equals x final. Now, there's a little bit of analysis here, which is a bit painful, so I won't dwell on it too long. But the assumption I'm going to make is that the time of tunneling is very long. Okay, I want, just by prescription, I'm going to say I prepared my system in a false vacuum, I waited a certain length of time, and I saw the particle at x equals x final, which actually I'm going to take to be infinity, at a definite time later, time t later. So it's post-selected. Okay, so if somebody is doing an experiment, they would literally observe the system, wait until it tunneled, note down that it hit infinity, that it got out of the well at a certain time, and store all the data with the same time of escape together. Okay, that constitutes an ensemble, and then in that ensemble, you can ask what happens to some other system which is interacting weakly with the system which probes that system. Okay, so that's the whole notion of post-selection. Now, to find the classical solution, by choosing the final x to be very large, all I'm saying is the solution hit a pole. Okay? And in the limit as x goes very large, all you require is that the classical solution encounters the pole at t equals t final. But that just means that t naught is equal to t final. Okay? So if we look at this classical solution, I get a pole if t naught equals t final. So saying xf is very large just means that I fix one of the two integration constants, t naught to be t final. Now, if we assume the solution has a small, nearly imaginary energy, i.e. m equals I epsilon, and epsilon will turn out to be positive, then I can go back to this Lambert solution. And you see, here I have a sine of u, but the m, which is the energy, so m will be I epsilon, there's going to be a small I epsilon multiplying t, so that when I follow the two exponentials, which are in the sine, and I follow it back in time to large negative times, one of them is going to get very large. And so this quantity will get very small, and that's the limit in which the analysis becomes easy. So I define z to be one of the exponents in the sine. It has this e to the minus 3/4 epsilon t. T is going to be large and negative. So this t is going to go back to minus capital T. And that means that z is going to become very large. Now I can do an expansion at large z and calculate x plus ix dot. Turns out there are two dominant terms, two terms which dominate, and the solution, the classical solutions, have to satisfy this equation. Okay? So it's a very transcendental equation that relates the energy of the solution to the time of tunneling, which was chosen, which was input as the post-selection measurement time. And so you have to solve the solution. It turns out the solution to this equation are well known. They're called the Lambert. This is called the Lambert function. There may be a connection to the Lambert series. I don't know. I think it's the same Lambert. This function was not tabulated until the 1990s. But then it was discovered in certain physics problems. And now it's available in Mathematica. So you can type in, it's called product logarithm. And so you can input some time t, and it will spit out the product logarithm. And roughly speaking, and it turns out there's an infinite number of solutions. Okay, so straight off the bat, and this is a totally generic feature, in a nonlinear problem, in a linear problem, like a harmonic oscillator, a free particle, there's always only one saddle point, and there's always a unique classical solution. In any nonlinear problem, generically, there are infinite number of solutions. Okay, so now there's a much more intricate analysis needed to decide which one of them is the dominant solution. The principal solution has n equals zero, and this turns out to be the one which I'll argue for a number of reasons is the most important one, the one we're interested in. This solution has a real part of epsilon given by log t over t. So, for example, in this expression on the left-hand side, when I exponentiate log t over t, I get t. Okay, and that's how the left-hand side manages to equal the right-hand side, where t is a big number. So the real part of epsilon turns out to be 1 over t times a log, so it's bigger than, much bigger than 1 over t in the limit of large t. The imaginary part is rather small, it's just 1 over t. In the same expansion, this Lambert expansion, you can calculate the whole action, by which I mean the classical action and the initial wave function, the minus x squared over 2. So when you combine these two things, you can compute all these integrals, and it turns out this is what you get. And so I could just do the calculation this way. I could imagine plugging in the classical solution for each m, and then stationarizing the final exponent as a function of m as a last step. And if you do that, you'll find all the same solutions. So you stationarize with respect to m, you'll find the equation that I gave on the previous slide, it's exactly the same. And then calculate the real part of the exponent. So if I want psi squared, I want the exponent in psi squared, it turns out this is what it's given by, where the imaginary part of m squared enters. So this imaginary part of m squared has two pieces. M is I epsilon. Epsilon has a big real part, well, not big, has a much bigger real part than its imaginary part. And so as one works this thing out, when you go to different n, essentially what happens is that the imaginary part jumps by an integral multiple of 1 over t. So here are all the solutions plotted in the complex M plane. This expression here is basically the inverse of the initial condition. So the initial condition, I've told you the time, capital T. The only parameter left is M. So if I plot this quantity, I'm interested in when x plus ix dot equals 0. Which values of m is this equal to 0? So let's just plot the inverse of it in the complex m plane. And every time there's a pole, that's a classical solution. So every peak in this plot represents a classical solution. The one closest to m equals 0 is this guy. And this is the one which, as I'll explain, we believe describes the tunneling. Now, if you look further at these solutions, then just using the calculations I've given you already, the real part of the energy is negative for all these solutions. And actually, when you work out the exponent, the e to the is over h bar, these ones are suppressed relative to that one. So the dominant solution has the of all the solutions with negative energy, the dominant solution is the one which is this one. The one which dominates the integral is this one. So they're all relevant saddle points, but in the limit h bar goes to 0, this one will dominate everything else. There are some other saddle points. They're saddle points with real part of energy bigger than 0. Okay, and these turn out to have a larger exponent. The e to the is over h bar is a bigger number. However, those solutions all have positive energy. And if you think about your original Gaussian wave packet, it wasn't really the local ground state of the harmonic oscillator, of the potential, because the potential has wings. Okay, so it doesn't really rise as x squared. It goes like x squared minus x to the fourth. So the local ground state, so a Gaussian wave packet, when expressed in terms of energy eigenfunctions, is going to include some components which have positive energy. And those describe the fact that the particle may already be in the process of tunneling. Okay, so your initial ground state has some wings. The wings will tunnel first, and that's what these saddle points describe. So they represent transients due to the Gaussian initial state being a local, not being a local false vacuum state. Finally, there's some other, there are lots of other saddle points, and they're all interesting. It turns out these ones down here have the exponent being positive. Okay? Now, if I'm doing some integral along the real x-axis, and my functional integral was defined on the real x-axis, On the real x-axis, the exponent is strictly negative, okay, because it goes like e to the minus x initial squared over 2 plus I, s, and s is imaginary. Okay, so, or I should say strictly non-positive. Okay, so it can be 0 if x initial is 0, but the real part is never positive. If I find some saddle point which is positive, okay, where the exponent is positive, you can be absolutely guaranteed that this does not contribute to the integral. Okay? And I may have time to describe that later. But these are saddle points which are irrelevant to the integral. Maybe it'll help if I give a little example. I don't seem to have any chalk. Is there any chalk anywhere? Somebody's been cleaning up a bit too vigorously. Anyone have some chalk in their pocket? okay. Pardon? Oh, wait. There are... Podium? Nope. I've looked at both sides. there's a whiteboard marker, which is totally unhelpful. No chalk. All right, I'll describe it in words. imagine I'm doing the integral e to the minus x. Have you got some? Oh, great. Thanks. So imagine I'm doing an integral from minus infinity to infinity I want to do this integral. Okay, so a very good integral. The integrand does that. And I'm going to do it by the saddle point method. So I've got to stationarize the exponent. So I say x plus x cubed equals 0. And so x equals 0 or plus or minus I. Okay, those are the three saddle points. So if we look in the complex x-plane, these saddle points are here, here, and here. The integral I want to do is along the real x-axis, so it goes bang through this saddle point. So there's no doubt that this saddle point is relevant to the integral. Okay? However, these saddle points, if you evaluate them, if x is I, you see I get plus 1/2 minus 1/4, so the exponent is plus 1/4. So this saddle point is higher than that one. So if I want to do a saddle point integral, you know, clearly I don't want to go climbing off in some other direction on this mountain range up to some other point and then coming down again. That's absolutely nothing to do with the integral. And so these saddle points are just irrelevant. Okay? And one can prove this in general, that any saddle point where IS over H bar is where the exponent is positive, but the exponent in the integral is non-positive, if you have such a situation, you're guaranteed it does not contribute to the path integral and it should be ignored. And that's the case for all of these saddle points. Now, a general technique for deciding which classical solutions contribute to the path integral is needed. It turns out this was never developed in quantum mechanics. It's kind of strange. For some reason, people just overlooked this problem. It is discussed in various papers. There was a recent paper by Witten a couple of years ago. But the only applications he considered were topological field theories. So, even though his paper is titled A Fresh Look at the Path Integral for Quantum Mechanics, he actually never did anything for quantum mechanics. And so that's interesting. There are rigorous results for finite dimensional integrals, some based on mathematics by Lefschetz. And there's some very beautiful results. You see, if you sit at a saddle point, there are two natural contours through every saddle point. There are down, or sets of contours. There are down contours, which flow down, where the magnitude of the integrand, in other words, the real part of the exponent, decreases as you go go down. So those are the descent contours. And there are ascent contours where the opposite is true. You can go up in some directions. And it turns out the down contours for any finite dimensional integral, it has been rigorously proven that the down contours and the up contours are dual, that basically they intersect at saddle points, and they're dual to each other in a sense of homology. And this is very useful. And what it means is then there's a rigorous theorem that if I sit on a saddle point and I want to decide if it is relevant or not to the integral I'm trying to do, then there's an if and only if statement. If I sit at a saddle point and I follow the ascent contour, okay, if the ascent contour from a saddle point hits the real axis, then I'm guaranteed the saddle point is relevant to the integral. It's if and only if. So clearly, if I'm higher and I ascend, I'm never going to hit the real axis. So this saddle point is definitely irrelevant to the integral. And that's part of this general formalism. So we've been discussing with Davide Gaiotto on using this. And we have, in fact, written numerical codes. It's possible to use this ascent and descent formalism in quantum mechanics. And those of you who attended Jacob's talk, Psi essay talk would have seen some pictures relating to that. So it's very interesting that, I mean, in my view, the semi-classical approximation, which this is, has never really been understood in quantum mechanics. And in particular, the question of deciding whether a saddle point is or isn't relevant to a path integral seems not to have been addressed. Now, with all that, let me show you the saddle points, okay? So here is the classical solution that describes tunneling in minus x to the fourth potential. And what you'll notice is that it starts off, it satisfies x plus ix dot equals 0, which tells you it must be circulating anti-clockwise. And here it is. This is for some time. I think it's a time of 30 in units where the harmonic oscillator period is 2 pi, so I guess it is 5 oscillation units, which you can probably see from the picture. So the particle oscillates 5 times before running off to infinity. Okay, so this is what a particle is doing when it quantum tunnels in the semi-classical limit as h bar goes to 0. The particle is literally following a complex path. Its position is not a real number. And what it does, the way it gets around the barrier is by, first of all, growing the amplitude of the oscillation. That's a result of the nonlinearity in the equation. So x double dot is minus x. The solution would be e to the it. It would just stay at fixed size. It's the x cubed term that causes secular growth in the solution and that causes it to get bigger and bigger. And eventually, it goes around the barrier in the complex x-plane, comes in from the outside, okay, and then rolls off to infinity. Okay, so that is how a quantum particle tunnels. And my claim is that if you do the right experiments, you will see that happening. And I'll explain that in a moment. Here it is for a longer time. There's just many more oscillation periods in the false vacuum before the same thing, before running off to infinity. Now, you might notice that just before it tunneled, and this is 1/4 period before it tunnels, okay, one full circuit here is a period. A 1/4 period is obviously from here to there is a 1/4 period. So if I look at the particle 1/4 period before it tunnels, it has a very large imaginary part. Okay, that's the main experimental signature of this process. And we can see that, we can explain that by looking at this double periodicity. You see, I'm trying to, the particle has to, this is the complex T-plane. So I'm interested in Ti being large and negative, and the particle is a solution for real T. Okay? So actually, the first thing is let me explain the connection with the Euclidean instanton. The connection is the following. I really want this solution. This is the solution in real time. Okay? However, the action is an integral dt. So it's a contour integral. You're free to evaluate a contour integral along any contour that's convenient, okay, as long as you don't deform the contour through poles or other singularities, or if you do, you better take them into account. So let's see if we can take this contour and deform it into the imaginary time contour. So this is very easy. What I do is I deform the contour along the line of zeros of the solution, okay, in the complex t-plane. So x is small, so the action integrand is small, and there will be almost no contribution along this line in the limit of small m, which is large t. So I run along the zeros, but ultimately I want to end up at the pole. So I have to, at the last minute, dive downwards back to the real axis. And when I dive downwards, then for small m, this is precisely the 1 over Cauch solution. This is the Euclidean instanton solution. And so the exponent I get is exactly the Euclidean instanton solution in the limit of that given by the Euclidean instanton solution in the limit of large t. Now, the other feature which I mentioned is that if I think about real t, in real time, this m is very small, okay, in the limit of large t, which means these lines of poles are nearly parallel to the x-axis. So it means that 1 quarter period before tunneling is here, and this part is rolling to infinity. So 1 quarter period before tunneling, I'm going to come near a pole. And when I come near a pole, obviously, the imaginary part gets very large. And the imaginary part of x goes as 1 over epsilon, because the pole is displaced by epsilon from the real axis. And so the imaginary part has to go like 1 over epsilon, which is a big, big number, t over log t. So the imaginary part becomes large just before tunneling. That should be the experimental signature of the complex nature of reality in the semiclassical limit. Let me quickly do a cubic potential. It's more or less the same. We can again scale everything out. This is the general solution. It's given in terms of Weierstrass functions. Weierstrass functions are just like Jacobi elliptic functions, but they have double poles instead of single poles. And that's again easy to see because x cubed has to cancel x dot squared when x goes singular. And that only happens if x goes like 1 over t squared. So this turns out to be the general solution. Here's the energy and their various constants. And here is the classical solution for tunneling in a cubic potential. Again, you spiral around, you orbit around the false vacuum before you have a big jump in the complex plane and then roll off to infinity. And here's one for a longer time, and you can see all this in much more detail. Even larger imaginary part of x, because there are double poles in these solutions. So this, the imaginary x goes like 1 over epsilon squared in this case. Now, it's nice to try to verify this in the conventional approach. One would like to see that if I solve the Schrödinger equation and compute some expectation value of x, do I get these classical solutions? It's actually quite tricky because you have to take this limit h bar goes to 0. Okay? When you take h bar goes to 0, you find that you need a lot of grid points because the wave function becomes more and more oscillatory, and so it's quite tricky to do. Nevertheless, I've made a stab at it. This still needs improvement, but here's a very crude attempt. Here is the real part of the initial wave function. Here's the imaginary part. I won't really explain this. This is some particular initial tunneling state. And here's a final state. Obviously, you don't want to pick a delta function. That would be too severe. But the idea here is I take my initial wave function, evolve it forward in time to time t. I take the final wave function, which is approximately a delta function, evolve it back in time t, And then I compute the overlap integral, psi f star x psi I, at time t. That is the post-selected expectation value of x. And here it is. So the classical solution for the corresponding initial and final data is this one. And here's my post-selected expectation value computed by solving the Schrödinger equation when I think h bar is 1/20. Okay? So it's kind of roughly in agreement, but this is, as I mentioned, still preliminary. Now, you might say it's all very well to compute the exponent, which we get from the classical solution. What about the prefactor? I mean, it's not much use just knowing the exponent of a saddle point integral. We want the wave function, and that includes the prefactor. So it turns out the prefactors are surprisingly easy to calculate in this real-time formalism. They're almost trivial. Okay? So let me show you that. We expand around the saddle point solution, so the classical action, and by this I mean the whole thing, including the wave function, initial wave function, the classical action plus some second-order fluctuation operator. And I just have to perform a Gaussian integral around it in that fluctuation operator. There's a nice method due to Gelfand and Jaglom, which says that first I discretize that action. And in this case, I get the usual kind of second-order differential operator appearing. This I epsilon h bar over ml squared, that comes from the initial Gaussian wave function. That's where the L comes from. And what you can easily show is for this determinant, there's a recursion relation. Okay, so if I just consider the determinant of n by n matrix, as opposed to n minus 1 by n minus 1, then you can easily show, because there are only a few extra terms that come in at each level n, you can show that there's this exact recursion relation, which when you go to the continuum limit, goes to this. So in other words, the functional determinant just obeys the fluctuation equation. The O hat delta x equals 0 equation is actually obeyed by the functional determinant. And furthermore, you need some boundary conditions. It's easy to see what they are. A 1 by 1 matrix in the limit epsilon goes to 0, the determinant is obviously 1. A 2 by 2 matrix, I've got to multiply this by that and subtract that, so I get 1. Then I get this term times 2. And if I did it right, which it doesn't look like I did, I think I've got an extra 2. D dot would be the difference between D2 and D1 divided by epsilon. This is the right initial condition. So D is 1 and D dot is I. And you can see that from this calculation, for example, I get the in a free particle Gaussian wave packet, there's a prefactor, which is square root of 1 plus IT. And that's exactly what you get in this method. So all we have to do is input our classical solution to get omega, find the solution of this differential equation with those boundary conditions, and we have the functional determinant. And then the post-selected expectation value is given by the sum of all the saddle points with the appropriate prefactors. So this is all totally doable. Sorry? Correct. That's a weak expectation value. I have used it. You can call this a weak value. Yeah, by the way, I mean, just to emphasize, this is not a real number. Expectation values of Hermitian operators are only real if the states on both sides are the same. So if this was IXI, it would have to be real. But because it's FXI, it's not a real number in general. Well, okay, so here's the $24,000 question. Can we detect the fact that this expectation value is complex? And i.e., can we test the reality of reality? Okay, that's a joke, by the way. that was the original title of my paper, A Test for the Reality of Reality. I sent it to Aharonov, and he told me it's too out there. And so I changed it to quantum tunneling in real time. But then Michael Berry wrote back to me and he said, I like the title, this is perfectly good. So I sort of regretted having changed the title. But that's what we're doing, is we're testing whether the reality is described by real numbers or complex numbers. Now, I probably made this clear already. You see, if I prepare a system in some initial state and I detect it in some final state, then this is the correct expectation value. And the next step is to say, well, if I now probe the system as it was making the transition from one state to another, what does the probe system respond to? And the answer is it responds to this number, not IXI. It responds to this number. So one can show that explicitly by coupling it to a measuring device. So let's take our original Hamiltonian and add to it a Hamiltonian for a pointer. Okay, so this is called a von Neumann pointer. And a von Neumann pointer is the simplest possible thing you could imagine. It's a free particle with mass m. In fact, it will turn out that even this term is totally irrelevant to the argument. I just need some other system. It doesn't even need to have any momentum. The only thing it needs is that an operator for the measuring system interacts linearly with my system, X, the tunneling system. Okay, so that's a totally generic thing. There's a weak coupling, G is very small, and there's an interaction that just switches on momentarily. Okay, that's a weak probe of your tunneling system. Now, it's easy to see that classically, what this does is it takes the pointer. So imagine the pointer had position X. Okay, and you evolve with this. Well, the Hamilton equation is that x dot is dHdp. Okay, capital X dot, the position of the pointer, is dHdp. Well, dHdp is just gx delta. So the shift in x is g times little x. That's what it does classically. It takes my pointer, shifts it by g times little x. By the way, the pointer momentum is strictly zero always, even though the pointer moves. Okay, and as you know, in classical mechanics, momentum isn't always velocity. Okay, momentum and velocity are independent things, and here they certainly are. This pointer has zero momentum always, but its coordinate jumps. That's what happens classically. Now, quantum mechanically, it's again very simple because P commutes with the Hamiltonian. Obviously, there's no capital X. So we can work in a momentum basis. And then it's obvious what the interaction does. You evolve your particle wave function into the interaction. The pointer has momentum capital P. So for example, the pointer will be in some Gaussian centered on zero, centered on P equals zero. And then I just multiply the wave function by this guy. Now in the semi-classical approximation, I can just replace X of T with X classical of t. That should be of t measure. So this becomes a C number. Okay, and all I'm doing is I'm changing my pointer wave function by a phase that depends on p. Now, the real part of x classical is just a phase for the pointer in momentum space. That means a shift in the pointer's position. So the real part of x classical will cause the pointer to shift by g times the real part of x classical. But the imaginary part of x classical is a real, contributes a real exponential. So imagine I have a Gaussian, e to the minus capital P squared. I multiply it by a real exponential. What that does is shift the center of the Gaussian. So my pointer now acquires a momentum at the measurement, something which was classically impossible. Under post-selection, is exactly what happens. Okay, so you post-select the particle position, and the pointer is now moving. So the effect on the pointer wave function is that the expectation value of the pointer shifts just like it would classically. There's no h-bar in this equation, but the pointer momentum shifts by gh-bar. And this you could call quantum post-selection bias. You've you've created an effectively an anomaly in this conserved quantity through a bias you introduce by selecting the final state of the system. Then, as Aronoff has emphasized, such things can be measured. All you do, even though this has to be small, g has to be very small, and so this effect is necessarily tiny in a single experiment, all you do is repeat the experiment an arbitrary number of times, and you can see the statistical bias in the pointer momentum. Okay? So literally, you can detect the fact, you can detect the imaginary part of the particle's trajectory as it is tunneling. In order to do that, you need super high time resolution, because you've got to see it a quarter period before it's tunneling, but that is now possible. Notice, by the way, that even though this goes like h-bar, you might think it was really small, in the limit of small h-bar, the imaginary part of x goes like 1 over epsilon, okay, where epsilon was the epsilon controls the tunneling time. And so 1 over epsilon is actually capital T. So basically, I've got h bar times capital T. And now I ask, what's a typical time that I would see a tunneling? Well, the capital T would be exponentially large. It goes like e to the 1 over h bar. So the shift in the point of momentum goes like h bar e to some number over h bar. Actually goes to infinity as h bar goes to 0. Okay, so in the limit h bar goes to 0, of course, the tunneling becomes very rare, so the poor experimentalist's got to wait a long time. Okay, but if they do this experiment, this shift becomes exponentially large. And experiments may be possible in quantum dots, and I'm discussing with some experimentalists about that. There are lots of generalizations. You can include all these effects I talk about. And now let me switch to actually my original motivation, which was in quantum field theory and cosmology. Quantum field theory, much harder, okay? Infinite number of degrees of freedom. It's not quantum mechanics. But very interesting in a variety of contexts, one of which is the real world, that from LHC data, if we do not introduce any more particles into physics beyond the standard model, and there's no evidence for them, apart from dark matter, but let's assume the dark matter doesn't have a dramatic effect on the Higgs field. So the Higgs field and the standard model, the weird thing about it, it's metastable, okay, according to the LHC measurements. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. So it will tunnel. So this is a very real question. What is going to happen to our universe? And to answer it, you have to do quantum field theory and tunneling in quantum field theory. Now, in principle, even though it's infinite dimensional, the principle is the same. We start off in a false vacuum, by which we mean that all the modes, all the quantum field modes, are in the ground state wave function of the false vacuum. Something which hasn't, I believe, been properly appreciated is that this initial state defines a preferred frame. You see, the Euclidean instanton is a very beautiful thing, and it's a very powerful method. But the Euclidean instanton solution, as I hope I've explained, does not describe real-time tunneling. I mean, in Euclidean description, a bubble of the true vacuum would shrink down to a point, bounce, and roll back out to infinity. That's the bounce solution. It's completely analogous to the particle in this problem, which rolls in from infinity, bounces off the potential, and back out again. That does not describe tunneling. Okay? Nevertheless, that's the solution you use. Now, people, because that solution in quantum field theory, the bounce solution, is Lorentz invariant, people have somehow assumed that the tunneling process is Lorentz invariant. Okay, and this is a typical assumption in the context of inflation, that it would somehow be de Sitter invariant. But it's important to realize that this state of living in the false vacuum defines a preferred frame, right? So on some time slice, okay, meaning some spatial slice of the space-time, I'm in the false vacuum. If I evolve forward in time, I'm going to nucleate bubbles. So it's pretty clear that if I Lorentz boost my initial hypersurface, on the one side it's got bubbles, on the other side it hasn't. So obviously the state is not Lorentz invariant. So you have to define some frame in order to say you're in the false vacuum. This solution, the bubble is necessarily time reversal invariant, and it's not the solution we're looking for. Nevertheless, this Euclidean method does provide some kind of description of the tunneling. And in particular, I believe it's entirely plausible that the spatial profile of the field when it tunnels is well approximated by the Euclidean instanton solution. And that's what I'm going to use. So all I'm going to use of this, I'm going to say the real-time aspects of the instanton are not the right ones. But the spatial profile, I'll take my instanton, slice it in two, use that as the spatial ansatz for the field, and it's entirely reasonable that that's a good ansatz for the emerging bubble. So here's the tunneling description in field theory, the Euclidean approach. You get some instanton, which is O4 invariant in Euclidean space. So it's a classical solution of the field theory. And you slice it halfway through and continue to real time. This is exactly analogous to what I did with the quantum mechanics, that the 1 over Koch solution goes to the sine solution. Okay, so this is what you do in field theory. And what I'm going to do is something which I claim is better, which is to slice the Euclidean instanton to fix the spatial dependence of the field, but allow the tunneling process in time to be described by the quantum mechanics as I have described it. So I take the action, I rescale fields just like I did with quantum mechanics. I get some overall factor. This will be my 1 over h bar times some dimensionless theory. I'm going to do phi cubed just for simplicity, a phi cubed field theory. There is an instanton solution to this field theory, which has a certain profile you can find numerically. And then I'm going to say my ansatz will be that the quantum field has that fixed spatial profile, but with an arbitrary amplitude. Okay? So you can imagine this quantum field trying to tunnel. It's going to wobble back and forth a few times, and finally it'll make it over the barrier. Okay? That's what this describes. So I fix the spatial profile to be that of the instanton. X is my amplitude or tunneling coordinate. Plug this into that, change variables, and I'll discover I have quantum mechanics in an X cubed potential. So the description of a field theory tunneling is just like quantum mechanics in the approximation where the spatial profile is fixed. That approximation will totally fail when the bubble starts to grow, but that's kind of obvious. We know that when you form a bubble, it will grow. I'm interested in the formation of the bubble. These are various moments. It turns out if I do this and I do the Euclidean approach now, then my Euclidean action is only 4% higher than the O4 invariant action. So I think that's evidence that this is actually a totally reasonable approximation. This is not way off at all. Suggest this should be an excellent approximation. At zeroth order, I just have quantum tunneling in a cubic potential, and you can improve the ansatz by linear theory response. But all the conclusions remain the same, that the quantum field will jiggle back and forward a while, and then it will tunnel and make a bubble. Now, let's get to inflation and the multiverse. So this is sort of the end of physics, as alleged by some, and experimentally confirmed, as alleged by others, but maybe not so fast. And the idea was simply that these bubbles would form in an exponentially expanding universe, and you would get a multiverse. Okay, it's precisely quantum tunneling. And according to Guth, anything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. And this is basically a total disaster for theoretical physics, because it means that you could never predict anything with certainty, because who knows where we are in the multiverse. Yes? Sorry? If you have no theory, you can't predict anything. That statement is true. They have no theory, so they can't. Yeah, no, if you have an infinite space, it's pretty hard to construct a measure. Yeah, yeah. Then, so, well, if you have an infinite space with some principle of homogeneity or some mechanism for ensuring large-scale homogeneity, you may get predictions. If you have no theory, then you don't get any predictions. So that's essentially the content. But what I'm going to say is that the whole basis for this picture seems to me to be totally flawed, okay? Which is that it relies on quantum effects. When people discuss the inflationary multiverse, the whole thing is quantum tunneling in a false vacuum de Sitter phase. But the treatment of quantum mechanics is totally heuristic, okay? So basically, in this Linde picture, it is done through classical noise. It's a stochastic approach. That's not quantum. There's no I anywhere in that description. In something like Lenny Susskind's treatment, I mean, it's literally just drawing bubbles by hand. That is all that is done. There is no calculation at all. Okay. So bubble nucleation de Sitter space-time. So I'm going to argue that the picture they have presented is wrong, even for bubbles nucleating in a de Sitter spacetime, for a couple of reasons. So remember I told you that the initial hypersurface, which was bubble-free, breaks the symmetries of the spacetime. You had to choose it. You could have chosen it to be an infinite flat slice. You could have picked it to be an open slice. You could have picked it to be a closed slice. The assumption has been that whatever you picked, it didn't really matter, because the bubble is Lorentz invariant, is de Sitter invariant. Okay, so but that's not true. Okay, so when you look at the bubble nucleation more closely, you see the key question is: does there exist a classical solution, complex? It's fine for it to be complex. Does there exist a solution which satisfies the right boundary conditions? The right boundary conditions means I need to specify all field modes are in the false vacuum on some initial hypersurface, and then I have to tell you that there's a bubble on the final hypersurface. Now, in this situation, there's no problem. Okay, we know about bubbles. They're called Kolmogorov-Delutia bubbles. And I believe there's no problem with those with a bubble nucleating here. The way you will see this, so I'll explain momentarily why this is true. A Kolmogorov-Delutia bubble describes, I think, correctly how a bubble nucleates, but it describes what happens when an incoming contracting de Sitter space undergoes a transition to an expanding one with a bubble. What happens if I pick the initial hypersurface on the throat? This is what inflationists would like to do. Okay, because they don't want to think about this part of de Sitter space, because it's anti-inflationary. Okay, so just by hand, people who study inflation ignore this part of the space-time. That's pretty ugly in itself. But they want to study this problem. The initial hypersurface sits here, the final hypersurface sits here, and there should be a bubble. Okay, and what they believed was that the Euclidean instanton, the Kolmogorov-Delutia instanton, is valid in describing this process. Well, is that true? So I'll tell you why I think it is not true in this case, and it is true in the previous case. You see, the point is I have quantum mechanics, but now if I fix the spatial profile of the bubble, I just have quantum mechanics, but the Hamiltonian is time dependent. In the action, you have a e to the 3ht, okay? And we know very well what that term does. It creates damping. There's Hubble damping in the expansion phase, and there's Hubble anti-damping in the collapse phase. So if we go back to asking, can a bubble nucleate in this setup, then there's absolutely no problem, because the field modes will become larger, due to the nonlinearity. And the anti-damping will only help. Okay, so the field will be doing its little orbit in complex space, and the size of the orbit will grow, and it'll jump over the hill, and that's what happens. Okay, no problem at all. But in this case, the field modes are trying to, if it wasn't for the expansion, the nonlinearity would be driving them over the hill. But the expansion damping just concentrates them back on zero. And here's a little numerical calculation where I take an X cubed field theory and I put it in a de Sitter background. And here's the solution trying to grow, okay? And then it encounters the Hubble time and the Hubble damping, and the Hubble damping just refocuses it on zero. So what I believe based on this is that there are no solutions which describe an initial hypersurface in the false vacuum and a final hypersurface way up in the de Sitter spacetime, many Hubble times away, on which the field tunneled. So if we try to describe this, there's exponential expansion of the universe as a big effect which counters the classical instability, and it seems that no solution of the desired form exists. Unfortunately, this is only negative. It just says the semi-classical approximation cannot describe the nucleation of a bubble far from the initial hypersurface. I don't have a constructive way of describing it, except to say, so all I can say is their calculations make no sense. I cannot tell them how to do their calculations. Okay? It suggests this is inconsistent with the semi-classical approximation. There is no complex classical solution. This may be a reflection of the fact that the semi-classical Gibbons-Hawking entropy of de Sitter yields a finite number of states. So in this global picture of the eternal multiverse, you have an infinite number of states. And when you try to describe bubbles nucleating up here, you seem to need an infinite number of degrees of freedom. But that is inconsistent with the calculation of the entropy of de Sitter space. There are interesting implications for the Higgs vacuum and for black holes. I'll skip through this. I think in view of the time, I will leave that for questions. Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's maybe take a few questions.
Have you thought of treating the simple, possibly simpler problem of chaotic eternal inflation?
Of what?
Of chaotic eternal inflation. So you've treated the fact that there's no bubbles from false vacua, but what about the case of just tunneling up an existing potential?
I think it will be the same.
Do you have any reason to believe that it will be the same?
The same reasons. There's not really much difference between false vacuum inflation and slow roll inflation. False vacuum inflation, I sit in a little valley for some time and then I tunnel out and roll down. In slow roll inflation, the damping is so big that I, very gently roll down. It's pretty much the same as staying still. So I don't think there's any big difference.
So in the first part of your talk, the quantum mechanical part, you treated a single particle. If you treated two particles, so question A, would your equation still be local? And in what sense, in what space would they be local? And secondly, would you expect to be able to violate Bell inequalities?
Great. Yes, the answer is that even with two particles or any number of particles or with the quantum field theory, the equations would be local in time and space because the equations are just the classical equations. And I'm solving them in real space and real time. The only thing that's complex is the field variable, the dynamical variable. So what I would say is, yes, this method opens up the semi-classical description of multi-particle tunneling. And that is generically not possible in the Euclidean approach. So in the Euclidean approach, there are very often no Euclidean solutions. in situations where there are 2 degrees of freedom and in which you know that tunneling happens, there is very often no Euclidean instant top. So whereas in this method, the problem is the opposite one. The problem is there are generically an infinite number of solutions, and you just have to search through them all and find the one that dominates. So, but yes, this method is perfectly extensible to systems with many degrees of freedom. It's just difficult. It's technically difficult. Because it's sort of a shooting problem. You have initial conditions, final conditions. You must solve the classical equations so that you satisfy both of those conditions. So it's kind of classical theory, but it's teleological. Okay, I have a final condition at a future time. You know, classical mechanics we think of as deterministic and mechanical. This search for complex classical solution is totally different. It's teleological, and the solutions are complex. The second question, can you violate Bell's inequality? I believe the answer is definitely yes. That if we think, for example, of, maybe go to a simpler case of the double slit experiment, where the initial wave function would be approximated by 2 Gaussians, one for each slit. And then the dynamics is totally trivial. It's just a free particle propagating in 3 dimensions. So the semi-classical approximation is exact in that case, okay, because the dynamics are done exactly right. What it tells you is the particle follows a complex path, which is a straight line in complex 3-dimensional space. X, Y, Z are all complex, but the particle will follow a straight line path in that complex space. The only approximation is the integral of the initial wave function, the XI integral, which will now have 2 saddle points. So what it tells you is that your final wave function is a superposition of 2 semi-classical wave functions, and they will interfere. And so you'll get all the quantum phenomena of interference and everything, and I think likewise, I expect you will be able to violate Bell's inequality through that, because you're still saying that the world is described by a wave function, it's a complex number, probability is psi squared, but I can get interference, I can get all of those other effects, even in the limit as h bar goes to 0. Just because there are multiple saddle points which contribute to psi.
So you described that in cosmology or for any phase transition that has that's tunneling from a false vacuum, the tunneling is actually not a solution, more or less. Could you see any way around this if the energy of the vacuum?
But that's not what I was saying. What I was saying is that it describes something very specific. It's just something that we're not normally interested in. If I take a de Sitter space incoming in the false vacuum, which is contracting, then there will be no problem nucleating a bubble on the within such a space because the field is going to be assisted in jumping over the hill. So perfect for that. It's just it doesn't happen to fit to with the application people have had
that
in mind.
So does that apply also if you wanted to use a first order phase transition for like in the concept of electroweak theories? Or
yes,
higher energy?
Yes. So in the electroweak theory, we know from LHC that if we extrapolate the standard model to large Higgs VEV, this is the effective potential of the Higgs field. Okay, and so we can guess that we're going to tunnel from here to there.
Yes.
So the question is, how do you do that calculation correctly? And this is, so you could think about today's universe as being in some prepared initial state, which we observe to be in the false vacuum. And at some point in the future, you're going to tunnel. The existing descriptions of this process are totally based on the Euclidean picture. And since this tunneling actually takes many Hubble times, okay, the same worry I have about the inflation actually exists here. Now, I have found another instanton, it turns out, where there is a real-time tunneling instanton, which is a complex instanton, which is not the one people usually use for this one. And that leads to a totally different conclusion.
Could we use that in context of, not for eternal inflation, but imagine that you would like to use it for standard first-order phase transition inflation?
Well, this is the future of the universe, so that's a first-order phase transition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we could use that.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm not sure whether I have understood everything, but that's why if I understood correctly, the weak value you connected in terms of the contribution from the complex classical trajectories.
That's right.
Now my question is, have you thought about any connection with super weak values?
No. What is a super weak value?
Well, I don't think actually there is any connection because that is applicable in context of finite spectrum.
I see.
I have a paper with Michael Berry about that. So weak, typical weak and super weak values. So.
Okay. Which I'm interested to learn about it. I don't know anything about super weak.
Okay, maybe one last question, if someone has one.
I wonder to what extent Josephson tunneling, which involves the tunneling of a wave function, is relevant for these considerations.
Mm-hmm. Josephson tunneling, which involves the tunneling of a wave function. Yes.
Josephson tunneling right. Is the tunneling of a wave function.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah, I would say if you want to study Josephson tunneling in real time, this is what you have to do. So the wave function in Josephson tunneling is a field, and you have to use this field theory. You have to find the classical solution, which will be complex, which describes the field hopping over the barrier. So it's absolutely relevant. I mean, I have to say there's a vast literature on quantum tunneling in the many-body literature, physics reports of hundreds and hundreds of pages, and I have tried to read them, but I have never found anywhere anything like this.
It is all semi-classical tunneling in a different sense.
Right.
Fermi's golden rule is used to take I, V, F, magnitude squared.
Exactly. Yeah, this was very important to keep track of all the phases all the time.
Okay, then let's thank Neil again.
Thank you.